This is the program that brings you news from around the world and also news about your life. And on Thursday mornings like this one, your health. This next report takes us to a soccer field near you, where young women players are more prone to injuries than men. In particular, women have a high rate of serious ligament tears in their knees. Researchers at the University of Cincinnati have come up with a prevention program aimed at keeping girls in the game. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
If you've ever wondered how it's possible to experience both the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat all in the course of one moment, meet soccer player Katie Landgrebe. A few years ago, she scored the winning goal in a tournament game.
I was on a breakaway with a keeper, and we were tied 1-1.
Just as Katie kicked the ball into the goal, she collided with her opponent, and her femur bone cracked.
I, fell down, and, everyone cheered, and then everyone was like, oh, no, what happened? And so it was pretty disappointing. I think everyone was kind of shocked.
In the course of rehab at the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, where she lives, Landgrebe started training with some researchers at the university who'd been focused on figuring out exactly why female athletes are more prone to knee injuries. Tim Hewitt directs the program.
So we've got about 30 girls training in the room, and what we're doing now is we're doing forward, multiple forward hop and hold exercise.
Side-to-side barrier tuck jumps.
As the girls go into deep one-legged squats, Hewitt explains that just after boys go through puberty, they tend to get a big power burst as well.
They get much bigger gluteal muscles, much bigger hamstrings muscles.
But with girls, there's not as much of a power spurt, and puberty brings a tendency towards favoring selective muscles.
Women tend to be very front dominant. They use their quadriceps, those big, thick muscles at the front of their thigh. That's how they control their knee joint.
This means that women don't fully turn on or activate the muscles on the backside, namely the hamstrings and the glutes. Hewitt says on the soccer field or basketball court, this is a problem. First off, the imbalance of muscle use, something Hewitt calls a muscle turn-on pattern, ends up putting stress on the ACL. This is the ligament that runs through the center of the knee joint, linking the upper leg bone with the lower one. Tearing an ACL, which women are up to 6 times more likely to do, is brutal, and it'll keep you out of sports for 6 months.
So these compensatory muscle turn-on patterns actually lead into the injury risk problem.
The good news is that through training, Hewitt says women can learn how to turn on and really activate and strengthen their underused muscles. But it doesn't happen in 1 or 2 sessions. Katie Landgrebe's mom, Sue Landgrebe, says she nudged for Katie's whole high school team to get training this year.
Last year, the Madera soccer team had at least three, maybe it was 4 girls go down with ACL tears just in the one season. And that's just uncalled for. That shouldn't happen.
Since all the understanding about gender differences is fairly recent, it's only now that evidence-based prevention programs are being developed. And Hewitt says to get the benefit, he's had the Madera High School girls soccer team in training 8 weeks this summer.
Okay, nice and deep. Hold, hold, deep hold. You feel it? Turn your hamstrings on. Good.
In order to change the way these girls land, jump, and kick on the field, Hewitt says they need lots of repetition.
Basically, ACL injuries don't happen when you have your knee flexed deep. So what we're doing is we're teaching them here to get deep into a flexed position, turn on all the muscles on the backside of their leg, at the same time controlling, stiffening their core.
The heavy demands of the training match the stepped-up demands these girls face on the field playing competitive soccer. It's still early in the season, but so far, Katie Landgrebe and her team are undefeated and injury-free.
I'm much stronger and just more ready to play.
The first injury of her soccer career has made her much more aware of how to prevent a more serious one. Now, hopefully, her whole team will benefit. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
One of the most anticipated video games ever is finally coming out this weekend. It's called Spore. There's so much excitement because it was created by Will Wright, the man who designed the popular SimCity and The Sims. His latest creation takes its inspiration from evolutionary biology, and for the most part, scientists are giving it a thumbs up. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
It took 7 years for Will Wright to finish Spore.
Why did it take so long?
It's kind of a hard game to make.
The game is about nothing less than 1 billion years of evolutionary history.
So basically, you start as this microscopic cell. Eventually, you kind of leave water. You continue to evolve for many generations.
You start the game in primitive waters, eating algae and trying not to get eaten. When you've grown enough, you can find a mate.
Then we mate, and what we're going to do now is lay an egg for the next generation of our species. And this is how I get back into the editor. And so I'm basically designing the next evolution of my species.
The editor is where you can add features to your creature. A new mouth, a nicer nose, faster fins, in later stages, faster legs, a bigger brain. You buy them with points you get from eating.
If you step way back, you know, evolution is about incremental improvement of a species embedded in a larger ecosystem over large periods of time. And that was kind of like the general presentation, the toy that we wanted to build of evolution.
To create Spore, Wright consulted with biologists and other scientists to get a greater understanding of the process of evolution.
Once you see this, you'll never think about abalone the same way.
Okay.
In this scene from a National Geographic documentary about Spore, Will Wright is consulting with marine biologist Tierney Teese.
Okay. Is this its mouth?
This is its mouth.
Ooh, that's cool. Looks like some kind of mechanical
buzz
grinder.
Yeah, and that's what we call radula.
I was sat with Will and had the pleasure of introducing him to a lot of really crazy animals out there that don't get a lot of silver screen time. Things like a radula. It's a buzzsaw-like mouth apparatus of mollusks.
T says the game isn't really a true mirror of nature, but she does believe it may help young people get interested in science.
I think there's so much potential for perhaps incorporating it into animal diversity classes. Or going tide pooling and then seeing mixing and matching, using the natural world as your inspiration for your virtual world.
Will Wright has built a career on games drawn with great detail. From there, he creates entire worlds that mimic the real one, says Chris Swain, a professor at the School of Cinematic Arts at USC. The Sims, which recreated the life of a real family, relied on behavioral science. Swain says follow-up game SimCity lets players take up real issues of urban planning.
And you get these 10-year-olds that can make these very sophisticated statements about what they need to do to their city to make it prosper. Lower the tax base and we'll raise the revenue here. And they say things that a mayor would say.
Spore gets even bigger. Your creature evolves into a species that develops a civilization that can be warlike or, as Wright explains, religious.
And we're going to go over to our neighbors here and try to convert them. Now, it's going to be a little hard because they're fairly happy, which is their best defense against religious conversion.
Depending on how your creature has evolved, whether it's been through dominance or cooperation, will determine what kind of cities you build during the civilization phase. Eventually, your civilization can conquer space. Spore goes on sale in the U.S. this Sunday, but already people are taking advantage of a preview where they can create creatures and share them online. There are more than 3 million to be found, waiting for their chance to evolve, mate, and eventually conquer the universe. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
When she took that bigger stage last night as her party's nominee for vice president, Sarah Palin emphasized her reputation as a reformer and an outsider.
When I stood up to the special interests and the lobbyists and the big oil companies and the good old boys, suddenly I realized that sudden and relentless reform never sits well with entrenched interests and power brokers. That's why true reform is so hard to achieve.
But a look at her record in Alaska shows that the reform spirit has sometimes been modulated to fit the situation, as NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Over the years, Sarah Palin's running mate, John McCain, has spent hours upon hours declaiming on the Senate floor. His target is congressional earmarks, the thousands of items that lawmakers slip into spending bills to send federal money to friends and neighborhoods. Last Friday, Palin said she's on board McCain's anti-earmark express. She brought up a controversial bridge project from 2005.
I told Congress thanks, but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere.
Yeah.
I said, we'd build it ourselves.
We'll come back to the Bridge to Nowhere in a moment, but first, a quick look back at Palin's history with earmarks. Nearly a decade ago, she was mayor of the small city of Wasilla, population then about 5,000. She hired Wasilla's first Washington lobbyist, specifically to get federal money. This isn't unusual in Alaska.
It's the bread and butter of how they do business in Alaska, and I think she got very good at doing business with earmarks.
Ryan Alexander is president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. The nonprofit group monitors federal spending and lately has spent a lot of time on Alaska. Alexander says that this year, Alaskans will get about $500 per capita in congressional earmarks, more than 10 times the national average. And when Palin was mayor of Wasilla, she did even better than that.
As mayor in 2002, now Governor Palin was able to get almost $1,000 per citizen of Wasilla.
And when Palin ran for governor in 2006, she lined up with the state's congressman and two senators in their quest for federal money. She spoke at the Alaska Professional Design Council Forum.
And our congressional delegation, God bless them, they do a great job for us. The strength of our delegation there in D.C., it's the envy of all other states.
She singled out Congressman Don Young for praise. He's the original legislative author of the Bridge to Nowhere earmark.
Representative Don Young, especially, God bless him, with transportation. Alaska did so well under the very basic provisions of the Transportation Act that he wrote just a couple of years ago. We had a nice bump there. We're very, very fortunate to receive the largesse that Don Young was able to put together for Alaska.
So what about the Bridge to Nowhere? Or, as residents of Ketchikan think of it, the bridge that would connect their city with its new airport across the Sound. Ketchikan City Mayor Bob Weinstein says that about 200,000 visitors a year use the airport and take a ferry to the city. Weinstein is a Democrat, although the city elections are nonpartisan. He says candidate Palin campaigned in Ketchikan in 2006 and told voters that she supported the bridge. She said she understood their resentment when it was ridiculed as a bridge to nowhere. Then, as governor, she canceled the bridge with a press release. But not the money. $223 million stayed in Alaska. So Weinstein says Palin's claim the other day, as he put it, didn't reflect reality.
She did not ever tell Congress thanks, but no thanks. She knows the state got all the money.
And Alaska got $38 million from Congress to build an approach road to the bridge. Under Governor Palin, that road is now being built. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Will Evans of the Center for Investigative Reporting helped to report that piece. You can find out more about the collaboration between CIR and NPR, the Secret Money Project, at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. In her speech last night at the Republican convention, vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin made a number of claims that we thought merit some scrutiny. So we turn to Bill Adair, editor of PolitiFact.com. The website is a project of the St. Petersburg Times and Congressional Quarterly. It's been truth-squatting claims by both sides in the presidential race. Bill Adair joins us from the Excel Center in St. Paul. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start by listening to one of Sarah Palin's digs at Barack Obama. She said, there is a lot to admire, but then she added this.
Listening to him speak, it's easy to forget that this is a man who has authored two memoirs, but not a single major law or even a reform, not even in the state Senate.
Hasn't authored a single major law or reform. Bill Adair, is that accurate?
Well, it depends on your definition of the word major, but he has definitely authored and passed what I think reasonable people would consider significant laws, one involving weapons of mass destruction and trying to help nations track down weapons of mass destruction and shoulder-fired missiles, another one involving nuclear materials to India, another one involving making government contracts more transparent. He also had significant accomplishments in Illinois on welfare reform, so I think she was exaggerating a lot there.
Sarah Palin also said that Barack Obama will add a massive tax burden to the American economy. Let's listen to some of the specifics she mentioned.
The Democratic nominee for president supports plans to raise income taxes and raise payroll taxes and raise investment income taxes and raise the death tax and raise business taxes and increase the tax burden on the American people by hundreds of billions of dollars.
Bill Adair, what about those claims?
Well, those claims are really quite a stretch. We have looked into these claims a lot that the McCain campaign has made. And what they have been doing is relying on a provision in Obama's tax plan that would not renew the Bush tax cuts for people earning more than $200,000 a year as individuals or $250,000 as families. So to the extent that taxes would go up under Obama, it really would only affect the wealthiest Americans. And so we gave that particular claim that she made about income taxes and payroll taxes a half true on our Truthometer. It's really quite a stretch.
You actually have a little image of a dial on your website, the Truthometer, and the dial is at half mast right there.
Yeah, we have found that the truth isn't black or white, that there's shades of gray, and so the Truthometer can help readers and listeners see exactly the relative truth of what the candidates are saying.
Well, Sarah Palin also made a number of claims about her own record in Alaska. Let's listen to one of them.
We suspended the state fuel tax and championed reform to end the abuses of earmark spending by Congress. I told the Congress, thanks but no thanks, on that bridge to nowhere.
I get a feeling we're going to be hearing that thanks but no thanks a lot in the months to come. What's your take on that?
Well, if only it were true that way. She really is exaggerating her role in this. I'm sure everyone can remember once this bridge became known as the Bridge to Nowhere, it became the most famous earmark pork barrel project and became a symbol of wasteful spending. And so Congress responded to a public outcry about it by withdrawing the specific authorization for it. So Congress had actually already begun the process of killing the Bridge to Nowhere. They gave the same amount of money to the state of Alaska, and the state decided to spend that money largely on other projects. So by the time it got to Governor Palin, for her to say, no, we don't want to do it, it really was already on its deathbed, and Governor Palin was really just performing the last rites.
Let's end by talking about a smaller point. Governor Palin talked about things that she has gotten rid of as governor, the personal chef and the luxury jet.
I put it on eBay.
And that, together, is true up to a point.
Indeed. She did indeed put it on eBay, and they tried to sell it there. They were unsuccessful and ultimately had to sell it through an aircraft broker. But the way she said it, I put it on eBay, was correct. So at least that claim earned a true on our Truthometer.
Bill Adair, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Adair is editor of PolitiFact.com.
Now for a back-to-school fashion critique. As students return to the classroom, teachers are finding themselves face-to-face with teenagers clinging to their skimpy summer styles. Commentator Anne-Marie Kelly Harbaugh teaches at a high school. As she explains, the boundary between appropriate and inappropriate school clothing can be a bit blurry. And we should say the name of the student, she describes, has been changed to protect the teen's privacy.
Rochelle was late. She wobbled down the hall saying, "It's not me, it's my shoes." I could see how 3-inch heels might slow a person down. But the rest of Rochelle's outfit? A glittered belt buckle, black mini skirt, and a clingy purple tee? Well, that could only be described as fast. We did have a dress code. No tube tops, underwear on the inside of your clothes, that sort of thing. But we struggled to enforce it. One teacher put it this way. "I'm a middle-aged man. I'm just not comfortable talking to a teenage girl about her body." Hearing this, a few of us female teachers decided to take the lead. School was no place to be sexy. We would simply ask students to change their clothes. As a deterrent, we put bins in our classrooms full of 80s sweaters and capes from Shakespeare skits. If necessary, students could pull out garments to cover halter tops or peeping thongs. I even rehearsed speeches for that day. "Before school, you have one chance to cover your body. If you miss, then it's my turn." So Rochelle could not sit in third period English looking like Tina Turner. We spoke in the hallway. "Hun, you are a lovely girl, but that skirt's too short for school." "None of my other teachers had a problem with it." I considered this and explained that we were tightening rules this year and people were still learning the policy. Reluctantly, Rochelle went off to change, and I claimed victory. It was a strange year, though. Rochelle's teeny skirts disappeared, then reappeared. Sometimes, in solidarity, her friends wore them, too. We dug into the costume box often. Clothing begot other battles. I kept Rochelle after class to conference about disrespect or her low grades. We just never connected. On day one, I had chosen her wardrobe as the most important thing about her. I don't think she ever forgave that judgment. The skirt could have been from her favorite aunt. Maybe Rochelle had gained weight and was self-conscious about its snugness. Or maybe Rochelle was just another teenage girl experimenting with an adult body. I remember that excitement. Curves were cool. But they encouraged me to walk down paths where my footing was uncertain. It would have been nice to have had an adult. An English teacher, maybe, who I could talk to about that. As a high school teacher, I care about the images my students project. But I care even more about the reasons they are projecting them. When I tell a young woman her clothes are inappropriate, she hears she is inappropriate. That's no way to start a school year or a relationship. These days, I save the garment box for Shakespeare skits. I can instill pride in my students without first resorting to shame. I have Rochelle to thank for teaching me that.
Anne Marie Kelly Harbaugh teaches English at James Hillhouse High School in New Haven, Connecticut, where today was the first day of school.
Barack Obama spent the day in Pennsylvania. In the city of York, he talked with workers at a hydropower equipment factory. Later, Obama spoke with reporters, and he was asked if he would go on the attack after last night's withering criticism from Republicans.
This is what they do. They don't have an agenda to run on. They haven't offered a single concrete idea so far in two nights about how they would make the lives of middle-class Americans better. They've spent the entire two nights attacking me or extolling John McCain's biography, which is fine. They can use their convention time any way they want, but you can't expect that I'd be surprised about attacks from Republicans. And by the way, I've been called worse on the basketball court. It's not that big of a deal.
NPR's Audie Cornish is traveling with the Obama campaign in Pennsylvania. And Audie, it sounds like Barack Obama is saying, I'm going to stay above the fray here.
He was, although he was far more forceful before reporters than he was with voters today. You heard him say he's been called far worse on the basketball court. And when we asked him what that was, he says it was unprintable, wasn't good for family air. But he also said that he called what happened at the convention the same old vitriol and slash and burn politics. While he's not directing his own attacks back, he is trying to sort of hold it at arm's length and identify it at the same time and say, look, this is what they're doing. We knew they would do this, and we've got to stay above it.
He's been talking about offering specifics. What specifically did he offer at this visit today to the factory in York, Pennsylvania?
Well, this was a factory that builds turbines, the kinds of turbines that are used in hydroelectric dams. And so the focus was on his economic platform, specifically his job creation programs, one of which focuses on investing in green energy, and another of which focuses on investing dollars in infrastructure to create jobs. And what you were hearing Barack Obama do is talk about instances like his tax code, like his jobs creation program, and be specific about it. And it seemed to be very basically a little bit of defense against the attacks on him that he's all skilled rhetoric or all oratory. And with voters out here in rural Pennsylvania, yesterday he was in Ohio, you see Barack Obama trying to get local, specific, and trying to make people understand that he does understand their lives.
If part of the Republican strategy is that having Sarah Palin on the ticket will appeal to women voters, do you get the sense that the Obama campaign is retooling in any way to make sure that doesn't happen?
Senator Obama was actually asked this question in the press availability. What he said is that he believes that Governor Palin does have a compelling story, but that she's being treated the way that men are being treated on the trail and the way he's been treated for the last 19 months. And he's also treating her as simply a shadow to Senator John McCain. And since she has the same platform anyway, he's saying she doesn't have much to offer beyond that. And of course, he's linking both of them to President George Bush. Barack Obama is trying to keep his attacks leveled at the Republican Party platform.
Okay, Audie, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Audie Cornish on the campaign bus traveling in Pennsylvania with Barack Obama.